Okay, so we're going to get started. I want to take the opportunity to welcome everyone who's here this evening. This shiur grew out of sort of two shiurim and have now been intertwined into one, and it's going to be an experiment, but went okay yesterday, so hopefully it'll go okay again today. You'll let me know. Essentially, there was originally scheduled to be a shiur on the thought of the Sama Rebbe, the notion of the three oaths, which we'll encounter in just a few minutes if you're unfamiliar, but essentially the question of activism, of the role of the Jewish people in being moving as a nation toward the land of Israel and resettling it, repopulating it. That's one topic. And the other one is, of course, of Kook on Zionism, the week just following, of course, the day, just more than 24 hours after the conclusion of Yom HaAtzma'ut. So it's certainly an appropriate time to continue our study of Rav Kook with a look at Rav Kook on Zionism. So what I'd like to do is to structure the class as follows. And we're going to be exploring Rav Kook's thought in contradistinction to that of the Satmar Rebbe. So I'll just give a very quick introduction to Satmar Rebbe. And then what we'll do is we'll examine his, what many would consider, very radical, and I'll just say from the outset, this one that I have tremendous trouble with, and I find even at time to be, although he's a great man, to be extremely difficult, if not frankly offensive, despite the tremendous reverence that I have for a Torah scholar, but still deeply troubling for me and for many others as well. And we're going to be outlining his position. It'll be part one of the presentation. And part two, we'll be taking Rav Kook and using the framework that we set up, outlining the position of the Satmar Rebbe, his opposition to Zionism, using that as a basis to then turn around and say, how would Rav Kook respond to each of the assertions of the Satmar Rebbe? So we're using, see, four fundamental assumptions, four principles of the Satmar Rebbe, and then we're going to use that as sort of the pivot for the shiur, and then we'll turn around and ask, how would Rav Kook respond? Those who are able to be here with us last week or last time, it was not necessary for this year, but we'll be building on some of the themes we begin to explore in order to elaborate the position of Rav Kook. So that's sort of the plan for the evening. Just a word of introduction to Rav Yoel Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rebbe. He lives a little bit later than Rav Kook. Rav Kook passes away in 1935. The Satmar Rebbe passes away, I believe, in 1979, so he's living much later. He was a Holocaust survivor, which is one of the fundamental differences, at least in terms of their life experience, is that Rav Kook passes away 4 years before the outbreak of World War II, and World War I, as we'll see, is a more formative experience for Rav Kook, whereas World War II certainly was a traumatic or certainly a critical moment, an episode in the life of the Satmar Rebbe. The Satmar Rebbe was a survivor. He was rescued, ironically enough, by a Zionist group in 1944, who smuggled him out of his community. He was the Rebbe, he was the leader of his community at that time. He lived in Yerushalayim for a relatively short amount of time, for approximately a year or two, and then he makes his way over to Williamsburg. He builds a community there. He then builds a community in Monroe in what's known as Kiryas Yoel, which becomes his community that he builds. I remember my time in Yeshiva University that President Richard Joel used to say that Washington Heights has now become Kiryas Joel. So that's the built on the model of Kiryas Yoel. So he really built that community, and he was well known in many regards for his teaching. He was certainly known as a renowned Torah scholar, as a serious leader among individuals in Klal Yisrael. And philosophically, in terms of his approach to things, he was particularly well known for his very strident opposition to Zionism, to religious Zionism, to any sort of Zionism, as is fairly well known. I think it's important to clarify from the outset that there are plenty of shades of gray. Sometimes we associate Neturei Karta, for example, fully with, which is well known as a very radical anti-Zionist movement, some of the members of whom have met with, very publicly, it's well known, with Ahmadinejad of Iran. But it's important to clarify from the outset that, although obviously that's abhorrent and beyond the pale of anything acceptable to my mind, and I'm sure many others here as well, that doesn't mean that all Satmar Hasidim believe that the fundamental principle of faith is that we should go and be so virulently anti-Zionist that we're going to support Sonny Yisrael, those who hate the Jewish people. There are many shades of gray. Things are much more complex. It's not our job tonight to outline all those shades of gray, but I don't want to be overly simplistic, and just because the media portrays or someone gets a large slice of media attention doesn't necessarily mean that that's fully representative of all aspects of a certain theology. There are certain core beliefs of the Satmar Rebbe which we're going to explore. I will also add that there are aspects, we're going to focus in terms of Satmar on certain, obviously, what many of us would view as negative aspects or problematic, questionable aspects of that approach, there are other things to be admired, whether it be the chesed in hospitals that we see in other aspects as well. And I think it's important to stress that, even if that's not the major subject of our discussion this evening.
Is Neturia Karta part of Satmar?
It is. I think it's associated with Satmar, but it's like a fringe group, I believe, under that umbrella. Okay, so what is the position of the Satmar Rebbe? So essentially, the Satmar Rebbe is very stridently anti-Zionist, and I'd like to frame his position on the basis of an article written by Dr. Lam. Rabbi Lam has a very interesting overview of the works of the Satmar Rebbe with regard to Zionism. Two primary works that he wrote in this regard, the most famous is Vayoel Moshe, published in 1959 and then completed in 1961, and then another one in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, which seems to, as we'll get to, seems to pose certain questions for the Satmar Rebbe, and that's written in 1967. The book is entitled Al HaGi'ula Ve'al Tzmura, which is a meditation, his understanding of that which will bring the redemption, and that which ironically attempts to bring the redemption, but will ultimately stop it, which is, of course, a reference to building the state, etc. So these are the two major works where the Satmar Rebbe outlined his theology, and Dr. Lam identifies four salient characteristics, four fundamental building blocks to the philosophy of Rav Yoel Teitelbaum. It says as follows. Number one, first one, is that human initiative cannot and will never bring about the coming of the Messiah. Only the divine. That's probably the most fundamental principle in his opposition to Zionism. He claims that from Herzl on down, basically what we're doing is these are human beings who are attempting to usurp the role of God in history. That's deeply problematic. That's almost heretical. It's almost as if to say that we are standing in, as it were, for God. Who brings about the Messianic era? That's a divine, this is his claim, that's an attempt of the divine, or that's a process of the divine in bringing out the coming of the redemption. Right? So for human beings, claims the Satmar Rebbe, again, controversially, but I'm just outlining his positions, he claims that that is essentially an act of near heresy, if not outright heresy. It's to substitute humanity for God. What is the locus classicus? What is the basic text which serves as the foundation for the Satmar Rebbe's position? So he invokes a fairly well-known Gemara, the Gemara that you have in front of you, where it says Ketubot on the top, Kuf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, page 111a, and we'll look at least part of the bracketed area. Here we find the invocation of none other than the three oaths, the three promises. This is based on verses from Shir HaShirim, where the daughters of Israel are adjured, take a promise on three occasions. That you are not permitted to hasten the love, this loving relationship, which is of course the metaphor of Shir HaShirim, before the time is right, before it is desired. So the Gemara picks up on this and explains as follows. Hahumi Ba'ilei, it's in the middle of the discussion, but we'll just pick it up. The relevant part, Hahumi Ba'ilei, a particular verse with regard to the daughters of Jerusalem is necessary. L'chid Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina. For the following position, Rabbi Yossi, the son of Rabbi Chanina, Da'amar, who stated, Gimel Shavuos Halalu, right, not to be confused with the 3 weeks, right? These are not the 3 weeks. In fact, I know someone who recently was giving a class in his synagogue, in his shul, and he wrote the topic in Hebrew. So the topic three in Hebrew he wrote was religious Zionism and the Shalosh Shavuot. He's referring, of course, to the three oaths, and an individual who publicized the class from the community wrote that the rabbi will be delivering a class on the topic of religious Zionism and the 3 weeks. The Shalosh Shavuot sounds kind of like the 3 weeks, and no one in the community can understand why in the world the rabbi is standing here in April talking about the 3 weeks a little bit the wrong time of year. So in any case, so it sounds like the 3 weeks is actually the three oaths. One is male, one's masculine, one is female, whatever it may be. But Gimel Shavuot Halalu, these three oaths, why? Achatz, this is as follows. Number one, achatz, shelo ya'alu Yisrael bachoma, that the Jews are not permitted to ascend en masse, to ascend, as it were, by a wall, in other words, by force, as it were, to retake the city of, or the state, or the land, I should say, of Israel, against, as it were, God's will. So we're not allowed to go up en masse to take the land by force as a community, as a nation. That's number one. V'achas. The second oath that is adjured. She'ishvi HaKadosh Baruch Hu es Yisrael. That God insists upon, requires of the Jewish people, she'lo yimredu be'umos ha'olam, that they will not rebel against the other nations, against the Gentiles. That's number two. And number three, and this one goes in the other direction. V'achas. She'ishvi HaKadosh Baruch Hu es ha'ovdei kochavim. God in turn requires that the Gentile nations take an oath, she'lo yishtabdu behen b'Yisrael yoser midai. Well, if you want the Jews, not clear exactly in terms of this, but the relationship between those we'll get to in a moment. But if you want to, if you want the Jews to be living in your country, you in turn need to ensure that you treat them with proper dignity, with proper respect. If you enslave or afflict the Jews in an unreasonable fashion, that is a violation of your oath. God communicates to the Gentile nation. So we have these three oaths, and this could be the topic of a class or a series in its own right. There has been a tremendous amount of ink spilled on the topic of the three oaths. The Satmar Rebbe, what's clear, and we're not going to go through all of his texts, but this becomes the foundational text for his opposition to religious Zionism. He says that to ascend in a political sense, to build a state, to build a country, to build all these farmlands, etc., is a violation, is a direct violation of the oath of the Jewish people not to ascend as a wall, not to rebel as well against the other nations, but in particular, not to ascend in mass, as we've said. He says this is deeply problematic. It is, again, an attempt to usurp the divine. In fact, the Gemara goes on to say that if the Jews violate their oath, God will, Hare ani matir b'sarchem ke'ailot ha-sedet, that I'm going to make your flesh, make it available, or make it permissible to the other nations to be devoured like an animal, like, in other words, a carcass of an animal that has been devoured by some sort of predator. So that's not a very pretty picture. And so the Satmar Rebbe picks up on this Gemara and essentially crafts a worldview which is consistent certainly with many other rabbis at that time. I don't mean to say he's the only anti-Zionist. The truth is that the majority of major rabbinic personalities at this time were opposed to the Zionist movement, including religious Zionism. We know that. But the Satmar Rebbe in particular picks up on this passage and claims that this is not just wrong, it's not just problematic, it is heretical, that this is the foundational text. This quietistic or pacifist type of philosophy is really a foundational principle of all Judaism, and the religious Zionists are not only in violation of a particular Talmudic passage, but of one of the essentially what becomes a fundamental of the faith. So this becomes the guiding text. Yes?
Where does Rabbi Hanina get it from?
Where does Rabbi, he quotes it. It's the drasha is based on his metaphoric rendering of these three oaths. Where exactly, how he came to understand that it's these three particular oaths. The Gemara actually adds another three oaths as it continues based on other verses. It's hard to know what exactly the precedent was. Perhaps this was just his own interpretation. Perhaps he had a tradition. We're not really sure. But this is a relatively early text that presents them. Beyond that, it's hard to say for sure.
Is there any other sources for something similar?
He tries to invoke sources, but this really, other ones, but they're not, I think, nearly as clear. He, building on this source, I think this is really his primary starting point. He spends most of his energy dealing with this Gemara. I will say that there are many possible responses that we're not going to focus on. You can imagine them from the outset to the opposition to Zionism. So, for example, take a look at Rashi. Rashi is bracketed on the top. Shelo ya'alu b'achoma. Rashi explains, Yachad b'yad Chazaka. What's Biyad Chazaka?
Strong hand.
Strong hand. What is Rashi adding to the text of the Gemara? What's his interpretation?
He agrees strongly.
Oh, he's armed agreeing, force. But what's the Yad Chazaka? Armed force. So let's say we're just going and settling, right? So I don't know about some of the underground. We talk about the Irgun and the Palmach, etc. That's a separate conversation, but certainly just to go and settle the land, one might infer from Rashi that that might be permissible, and that might be one response to Satmar Rebbe, thank you, that has certainly been offered. Others argue that to build an entire foundation out of this passage is unfair. Would you say that this is a halachic text about Jewish law, or is this an agadic text? This is more Jewish, I don't want to say legend, that I think is the wrong connotation, but certainly more of a story, a narrative, a lesson, rather than a strict Jewish law, if I were to ask you.
It's pretty clear what it seems to imply.
Right? Well, so on the one hand, it's pretty clear what it seems to imply, but at the same time, it's important to recognize that there is a difference in the status of a strict halachic text and a agadic text. Agadic texts are not always binding. Moreover, if I could find other texts that would seem to point in a different direction about...
That's why the sources.
Oh, the other sources, he deals with them. I thought you meant the other sources that support his contention.
That as well.
There are certain, right, that's what I thought you were asking about, but there's certainly sources in the opposite direction as well. There's a lot to say. I'll add one other point, and then we'll move on from here. The other point that's made is that the Meshech Chacha, Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, if you remember, those who were here last week, we introduced Rav Cook. We said he was from a town in Latvia that was fairly close to the town of Dvinsk, which, interestingly enough, that the Meshech Chachma supports a proto-Zionist position. The claim of the Meshech Chachma is, he says, we cannot read these three oaths in isolation from one another. He says, because it makes sense. The third oath, what's that? It's saying, well, if the Jews are not going to leave, they're not going to abandon their exile, and if the Jews are not going to rebel against the other nations, well, it's only fair in turn that the Gentiles treat them reasonably. But if they're going to engage in blood libels and pogroms and attack us during their crusades, right, and engage in all sorts of horrific, nightmarish Khmelnytsky massacres in 1604, and so on and so forth, there comes a point at which it's not just that the Gentiles have violated their oath, clearly. And for the Sadma Rebbe, writing after Rav Kook, after the Holocaust, after 1945, I think it's pretty clear at that point that the Gentiles have completely laid to waste any semblance of observing their side of the bargain. But aren't the two connected? If the Jews are in mortal danger, which is really Herzl's argument, he just attends the Dreyfus affair, and he sees that the Jews are being falsely accused, he sees what's in the air, he sees, if not completely, if he doesn't fully predict, he sees where this is all going. And so, says the Meshech Chachma, if the Gentiles are in violation of their oath, so then in turn, that oath is no longer binding on the Jewish people. So this is, I think, a very compelling response to the claim of the Sadma Rebbe. But he'll have nothing of it. He rejects that position, and he says they're not interdependent, and he makes claims in that direction. But if you read him, you see that he really is compelled by this text, and was the one that is most fundamental, to spend the most time on, his first assertion then really clearly that no human and only divine intervention or initiative can be a factor in bringing about the Messiah. So that's the first and foremost claim of the Sadma Rebbe, and now we'll move to number two. Second interesting claim, which I didn't give you the text for here, but he claims as follows. He says, there's one process that must precede the Messianic era. If religious Zionism is about an attempt to bring about the Messianic era, which it certainly was according to Rav Kook, so then, what should precede Yimot HaMashiach, would you say? Right? The process of tshuva, the process of return. Right? Shouldn't that tshuva process be a prerequisite to the coming of the Messiah? Says the Sadma Rebbe, the Zionists overwhelmingly are irreligious. They're not observant. They're not engaged in the tshuva process. If anything, these are people who have rejected the yoke of tradition. Their socialist Zionist ethos is directly counter to the notion of submission to God. Everything about them is counter to the traditional Eastern European observant committed Jew, and to the image of the Jew for thousands of years, to the tradition of Judaism for thousands of years. So clearly there's been no tshuva process, says the Satmar. Tshuva, he argues, on the basis of sources we don't have time to get into now, claims the Satmar must, by necessity, precede the coming of the Messianic era. So that's the second claim. How can you claim this is the beginning, the Mos HaMashiach, if the people are wanton in their ways, they're irreligious, and there certainly is no repentance afoot?
Does that mean that every Jew has to do tshuva?
I don't know if he would go that far, but he would at minimum require, I don't know, a tshuva revolution, like we've seen at other times in history, a great awakening, if you want to use American history as a...
How about the concept of, you know, keeping two Shabbatot, you know, in a row or something like this? Bring Mashiach.
Right. Yes, that is a Gemara.
What is the Satmar say?
I don't know if he addresses the Gemara on Shabbos. Well, it's in the Gemara, so yeah. I think the answer is he would. He would probably say that at that time the Jewish people were so close to sign. It's just, the Gemara says it specifically in context of the first two Shabbatot in history. So okay. It seems to be saying that, I would imagine he would read that as, at that time, the Jews are observing two Shabbatot, it's a sign of their high level of piety. In the immediate aftermath of the revolution,
I don't know if it's going to come up as a third or the fourth point, but I mean, in the second point is the exact counterbalance. If we lost our right to Israel and the temple because of our sins,
right,
to regain it,
right? No, that's correct. No, that's in other words, it's embedded in the notion of exile from a religious perspective. I understand. I wasn't going to present that separately, but it rounds it out very nicely. 100%. Okay, that's the second claim. Now the third claim is interwoven, but a little bit different. So I'm going to separate it, but you'll see it's interconnected. And here claims the Sadma Rebbe that the agents of the redemption, the actors in history, must themselves be pious Jews. Right? Now, this is very much related to the notion of tshuva, but in other words, it's a little bit different. In other words, one thing to say that tshuva must be a prerequisite to the coming Messianic era. The third thing, though, is that the Messiah himself, but not only Melech HaMashiach per se, but the individuals who are engaged in bringing about this process themselves must be religious individuals. The notion that Mashiach is being brought about by irreligious Jews is deeply offensive. And I'll share with you one text. If you take a look, the fourth page in the handout, it's labeled Resh Ted Zion, the fourth sheet. Altogether, second side of the second page, Resh Ted Zion on the top, right? If you take a look at the bottom, it's bracketed. It starts V'im Kain. I apologize, there are some who may have the small handout. If you only have two pages in your handout, you'll have to share with someone else. There's a little bit of mistake in photocopying. But again, in the larger handouts, the complete handouts, it's the bottom of Resh Ted Zion. If you haven't found it now, you're probably best off sharing. You're welcome to share with me as well. That's fine. I don't bite. Okay. So he says as follows, just to give you a sense, and this is a more moderate, frankly, passage in the Satmar. I'm trying to keep it light. he says as follows, V'imkein ela harishayim shehima kofrim gemurim. These evil individuals who are outright heretics, rachmana litzlan, right, God forbid, v'Hashem yisparech against God, uv'torasok dosha against his holy Torah, uv'divrei ha-neviyim, and against the words of the prophet, the prophets, v'odioter, moreover, mizeh shehima misitimu madichimu ma'avirim al hadas, they essentially cause others to sin against the religion, be'ofan ra, in a horrific fashion, asher kamahu lo niyasa, which is unprecedented, v'ayideha salasam osim shemido merubo b'Yisrael, through their successes, ironically, what they consider to be successes, actually what they do, is that, or Shem Diyot, they increase the level of dissociation from Judaism, of Shmad, of God forbid those who abandon our faith. Which is the passage there. He says, Hurak, the end of that line, Hurak Aideho skin batura umitzvot kol yom. The only people who can be the agents of redemption are those who are constantly engaged every single day in Torah and mitzvot. So this is the third claim of the Satmar, and he repeats this elsewhere as well. Now the fourth claim I didn't give to you, and I'm not going to focus on, but it's too appealing not to at least mention. I'm putting out there, and this is just food for thought as well. The fourth claim, says Dr. Lam, in summarizing the Satmar Rebbe's position, is that the Jewish state must be, well, cannot be a democracy, it must be a Jewish state, which is one way of saying it, or the more loaded way of saying it is to say the Jewish state must be a theocracy. A theocracy. Now, for us, in a post-1979 Iran, right, post-revolution, the word theocracy has a certain kind of frightening overtones, and for many of the theological opponents of the Satmar Rebbe did as well. There's no question about it. But basically, his claim is the state of the Messianic era of Zionism must be committed to Jewish law. Of course, he would define Jewish law in a particular way, but the broader notion is Jewish law must be committed to halacha. What does it mean that we're creating the state that will, God willing, be the harbinger of the Messianic era, but is not committed to the core traditions of Judaism for thousands of years, so claims the Satmar Rebbe, right? That's his position, right? You can see how the secular Zionists might have taken some claims like this, right? In other words, you are building a state which is anti-Jewish observance, which is anti the halacha. You see how this went. Right, not very well, but this is his claim, this is his position. He says the notion that there can be a Jewish state which is not fully halakhically observant, and then you want that Jewish state not only to be a Jewish state, not only to be the harbinger of the salvation of the Jews from the physical suffering of the Shoah, etc., but this is going to be the harbinger of the Messianic era, and this is your notion of the Jewish state, of the Messianic, right, of eschatology. This is how you envision it. It's inconceivable. I mean, this is really just, it's deeply problematic, it's wrong. So to summarize, these are the four fundamental assertions of the Satmar Rebbe. Number one, that only divine initiative can bring about the redemption, the return to Israel at all. Number two, that a process of tshuva, of repentance, must precede the Messianic era. Number three, that the agents of redemption themselves must be pious, must be observant, must be religious. And fourth and finally, that the Jewish state must be not a democracy, a Western democracy, but rather a full-fledged, full-throated theocracy. So those are his four fundamental claims. Now, these positions lead him to what some might consider some fairly radical conclusions. If anyone's interested in, I'm not going to read it both for time purposes and because I don't want to be accused of giving anyone an ulcer this evening, but if you want to take a look at the first three passages, you'll take a look, you'll see his introduction. So I'm just going to be, I'm going to be transparent about his claims, as at least I understand them and others as well. Number one, what led him to write this book, Vayol Moshe, in the first place? It is a spiritual accounting of, talking about theodicy, we're talking about how to read history, exile, and redemption, and this is his theodicy, interpretation of the reason for the Holocaust. I'm just putting it out there. I'm not, God forbid, endorsing such a view. And even those rabbinic anti-Zionists were deeply offended and pushed back against this very radical assertion, one that I certainly cannot live with. But he claims that the Holocaust is due to the sins of the Zionists, who essentially are engaging in this heresy, attempting to, again, usurp the place of God. And by doing so, that is the greatest of sins. And so the Zionist movement is the cause for such suffering. The rest is perhaps collateral damage, however we want to interpret it. This is sort of the opposite position of something I find equally as offensive, even as a religious Zionist, which is the claim that the reason for the Shoah is because of those who oppose Zionism, right? Or assimilation, or whatever interpretation you want to give. But in particular, it's very interesting. Rav Teichdal, the author of Ema Banim Smicha, is attributed with the position, is often quoted as having maintained, although I don't believe it's explicit in that particular book, but often quoted as having maintained that the reason for the Shoah is because of the opposition to Zionism, right? Which is sort of the 180 degrees opposite, or it's the inverse of Tzadma Rebbe, who claims that it's, of course, Zionist, which to me means that, neither one kind of disqualifies the other. To my mind, I find all these interpretations deeply problematic, but in any case, that's his claim, and that's how he opens, that's his introduction. He says, why do I write this book? I'm trying to account for the Holocaust, and the following 250-some-odd pages are my accounting. Yes?
A much more common claim is that the Holocaust was there to get people to go to Israel.
Maybe...
I mean, that is a foundational
Gush Emunim. We're going to get to Gush a little bit, although we talked more about it last week.
Think of the opposite.
That would be another...
Not that the state, not the Zionism caused the Holocaust, but that, mm-hmm.
Right, I got you.
It's necessary.
In order to... That's it's a different kind of inverse. It's right, I understand what you're saying. That would be another type of opposite as well, 100%. But that's what he claims. He says, wait a second, how can you claim that Zionists were responsible for all of this? After all, during this period of Holocaust, Gesundheit, that weren't the Zionists actually involved in the process of smuggling Jews out, of saving Jews? Right, sounds like a good thing. Is that how you understand that? So I'm just putting it out there, he says that he offers a metaphor. He says it's like an individual who is an arsonist, lights the fire, and then hangs around after having lit the fire and saves a couple of people at the end of the process. He says that's the same thing. He says the Zionists were religiously responsible for the Shoah. The fact that they stuck around to save a couple of Jews doesn't really do all that much to get them off the hook.
Right. Notion.
Yeah. I'm sharing. And by the way, I want to be clear. I don't, God forbid, mean to be little. I'm being honest about my response. You see, it's all over my face. I don't, God forbid, mean to be little. I just mean to be honest in the presentation.
No,
I'm just putting it out there.
And I'm just kind of exploring his thinking. There are lots of other things that one could argue led to the Holocaust. Why does he pick on this?
So there are... It's an excellent question. I'm very hesitant ever to psychoanalyze, especially an outstanding figure, and also it's just so it's so conjectury. I'm just conjectural rather that I'm just hesitant to engage in it. Yeah, I can tell you what people have said. People have suggested that this is a way of coming to grips with that trauma. It's sort of an account. It's one which allows for a scapegoat. It's one that allows his community off the hook and allows it to place the blame on a diametrically opposing philosophy and say that our communities, because his community was for the most part decimated in the Shoah, he was smuggled out, but I don't believe there were all that many others who made it. So it's a way of saying that we're the righteous ones, and that's the only reason that we pass, and it's actually, we're embracing, now we're, what we're doing is we're actually embracing the very opposite philosophy as almost a way, a tikkun, as it were, as a way of, and again, it allows for a certain extremism, which in response to a traumatic event, I think is not uncommon either. That's what people suggest. I'm sort of, to me, it's kind of
a psychological explanation.
Right, that's,
said, why are you picking this as opposed to
because I think it's true, because I read the Gemara, and this is MS, because this is, because we believe that, that's our role is to accept God's dominion and to follow his pathways and to accept his dominion.
The argument doesn't hold water because pre-Shoah, mm-hmm. it might have. Mm-hmm. Post, when the actual establishment of the State of Israel mm-hmm. happened
okay.
successfully.
Good. Good. Okay. So now.
Against all odds, it actually proved.
So now he says. Good. So now he asks the question. Great. So this is the next step, and this is going to be the final step in what is admittedly a very incomplete presentation of his position. So he asks the question, how do we understand the seeming miracle of the founding of the state, and how do we understand events like the Six-Day War? That I said he wrote a book. There's a reason he had to write a book, because it undermine, aren't these miracles? So in a word, the Sama Rebbe's reading of the State of Israel, and again, this term is borrowed from Dr. Lam in that same article, it is essentially demonological. Demonological. What do I mean? He identifies specifically Samael. Samael is associated with the Sitra Achara and these negative angelic personalities, as it were. And essentially, basically, the claim is that these are all tests. These are all demonological tests which are meant to ensure or to test whether or not the Jewish people remain true to our quietistic pacifist faith, or do we get on board with the Zionist movement. That's how he understands the events of 1948. It's how he understands 1967. He says, how do we understand Six-Day War? And this is, it was so shocking. So he says, number one, it wasn't really such a great miracle after all, and it is a military perspective. Okay, that's number one. Then he says number two, but even if you want to claim it was all that miraculous, actually ironic, it's sort of the opposite claim in a way. He says, well, actually, the more miraculous it was, the greater the test it is. And that's really the point. So this is all the act of Samael. So in sort of either way, it's he's able to downplay it. Again, this is sort of what for many would be reductio ad absurdum. It shows the extreme nature of this position, shows its absurdity. Of course, many have said that one person's reductio ad absurdum is what we call another person's in hachinami, which means in hachinami, meaning a Talmudic notion that yeah, you're right. So that's what you would say. So to you, it's absurd. To me, okay. But to me, that's logical. It's not per se flawed logic unless you just think it's completely absurd. So that remains the debate. I'm saying.
What year was it
published? Vayal Moshe is 1959 first, and then he adds parts in 1961. The later one about the Six-Day War is in 1967 proper. This is all Vayal Moshe. Different book. That's entitled Al HaGeulah V'Al Tumurah. Different book, yeah. Okay, so there's much more to say, and I hope I'm not being unfair or incomplete, but these are some of the classic positions of the Sama Rebbe. Now, I want to stress that this is not a holistic or complete picture of anti-Zionism. There are many in fact, the overall majority, do not maintain such radical views. They're opposed to Zionism for reasons of, again, of maybe relative pacifism, maybe not associating with the heretics, maybe because we want to build a more religious kind of state, maybe because they don't, they're opposed to Torah study or don't appreciate our values and so on and so forth. But certainly the Sama Rebbe has this more extreme kind of view. So I'd like to do now, yes?
Would he have been opposed to Jews returning to Eretz Israel? And just living there?
Great question. So let's remember, he himself lived there for a year or two after the Shoah, and there is a sizable Satmar community. He actually came back to visit every few years to visit, spend, I think, a few months at a time to visit with the communities there. So it seems pretty clear, although there is opposition. Certainly we know the Satmar is, they won't take any money from the state and so on and so forth. Question is what that means. In other words, they still use the state's electricity. They still the garbage collection, etc. But to the extent that it's also inconsistent, there's a radical consistency in Satmar, which I think is to be respected, even if we disagree. But there's a certain as best they can consistency there. It seems that what they claim is to associate with the state, with a sort of a public or national engagement, that's profoundly problematic. But to live in isolated communities, dissociating ourselves from the Medina in every way possible, that seems to be legitimate within his approach. That's what I think he would say. I think that's pretty clear. Okay, so that's sort of framing this view. And for those who are ready to move on to an alternative worldview, so swoops in Rav Kook to save the day. So what I'd like to do is to frame the position of Rav Kook around, not only for those who were here, some of the themes of last time, but more around these four assumptions of the Satmar Rebbe. I think it's a very convenient frame. And basically to look at each one and see how would Rav Kook respond to this fundamental assertion of the Satmar Rebbe. So that's going to be essentially our project. So let's go one by one. So we had said that the first assertion of the Satmar Rebbe is to claim that only divine initiative can bring about the end of these, and a not human initiative. And in particular, the classic, the locus classicus that we saw, the passage in Masechet Ketubot. So how would Rav Kook and other religious Zionists respond to this particular claim of quietism, of pacifism, of the three O's? So we already mentioned a few responses that one could imagine offering, and that many have offered to building this philosophy around this Gemara. That's certainly true. But Rav Kook is actually living before most of those conversations. He passes again in 1935, certainly is not responding to the Satmar Rebbe. Our dialogue this evening is a completely imaginary one. They never met, they never got together. Satmar Rebbe again was in Eastern Europe until 1944 when he was saved. So they never had that opportunity to have that conversation. But Rav Kook, in general, Rav Kook doesn't respond extensively to the passage of the three O's per se. Many of his students do. Rav Aviner, who is a well-known rabbi, and very influential rabbi living in Israel, has written a book responding to Kuntres Shelo Ya'alu Bachoma, responding to this passage in the Gemara. So there are many responses. I'd like to share two perspectives of Rav Kook in response to this point. The first point that Rav Kook makes, and you can begin to turn now to the passages of Rav Kook, you'll see that it's a different text, a different layout. And the first passage of Rav Kook reads a Grot HaRa'aya on top. I've taken many of the passages from his letters. I mentioned last time that much of the writings of Rav Kook is esoteric, obscure, downright impossible to understand, admittedly, especially if you're not steeped in the wisdom of the Kabbalah. His letters are a little bit more accessible, they're a little bit more readily understandable. So I'd like to start with this one, and this letter, essentially Rav Kook defends the Zionist project, the religious Zionist philosophy, and his point here is a subtle one, but an important one. He says, the argument, and we're going to read Pat Avin, but let me just frame it. He says, the claim that the religious Zionist movement is this sudden break in history, where until now we never attempted to ascend, and all of a sudden now we've just created this political machine, essentially, which is attempting to rebuild and to retake the land of Israel, that's a little bit of an oversimplified kind of narrative. He says the truth is that spiritually speaking, historically speaking, the modern Zionists, whether or not they know it, the laborers, even the secular Zionists, are actually an extension of a process of attempts to return to the land of Israel, which has begun really since the beginning of the exile, and in particular picks up on the tradition of many pious Jews. He doesn't mention all, but for who can we name as pious individual Jews who began to make Aliyah? Right? So, right, starting in the Middle Ages, let's say, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has the famed attempt to make Aliyah, the classic story, which is a legend, more than myth, more than fact, but I think speaks to certainly his goal of returning the land of Israel, that he was trampled, the Arab horsemen immediately as he entered the land. Certainly, whether or not Rabbi Yehuda Halevi made it, he attempts to make Aliyah. He's a great lover of Zion. The Ramban Nachmanides, in the aftermath of his disputation in 1163 with Pablo Cristiani, finds himself exiled at the ripe young age of 71 or so. He's in his 70s, and the Ramban makes Aliyah. He goes to Yerushalayim. He builds a yeshiva, I believe, in Akko. So the Ramban certainly goes and makes Aliyah. The Ramban Shul, those who have been to the Churva, the Ramban Shul in Jerusalem is authentically a place where historians believe the Ramban prayed. The Ramban. We have others as well, moving, I'm jumping many years in Jewish history, of course, but the students of the Vilna Gaon, moving closer to the Zionist movement. Says Rav Kook, these are not sort of isolated incidents that have no continuity. There's been this attempt to return on the part of as many Jews who could. These are individuals, but they represent a movement. They represent the love of the land of Israel. They represent an attempt to resettle the land as best we could, given the limitations of what we had. In particular, students of the Vilna Gaon, they come, they set up the yeshuv, and they don't do much in terms of farming because they're focused on their Torah study, but they do begin to build a community. And says Rav Kook, both sort of from a secular historical perspective, but a religious historical perspective as well, don't see this as a sudden break. Herzl begins a brand new movement, unbeknownst perhaps to Herzl, he's actually continuing a long-standing tradition. And here Rav Kook writes very movingly, and his passages have beautiful content, but if you can understand them, a flowery, not just flowery, really inspirational language as well, and it's just beautiful to read. So take a look at the bracket here on this page. Says Rav Kook, V'hine, Mikedem Zot, before the modern historical Zionist movement, Hofia Atzad Hashem al Yechidei HaTzadikim, the wisdom of God appeared upon the these unique righteous individuals, Kidoshei Elyon, these sanctified, these elevated, sanctified individuals, Midorot Shelefanenu, already from preceding generations. Sheed Situ Libar Ish Kodesh Shel Hevet Bo Eret Ahavat Kidushat Eretz HaKodesh Bilavav Am Hashem, who were ignited by this flame, by this fire of a love of the holiness of this, of the holy land, the sanctified land, in the heart of the nation of God, umiyadam haytazot, and it was through their hands, through their attempts, their efforts, shnit kabtsu yichidim usridim le'eretz haneshama, that individuals and the remnants gathered to the barren wasteland, adasher chalakim chashu v'mimenu hayu baruch Hashem l'gan Eden, until the point now where we actually have real communities, where we've actually really built. We've built farmland, kibbutzim, etc. But our achievements now are an outgrowth of a tradition of attempts that have been ongoing for longer periods of Jewish history. This is not truly, in the full sense of the word, argues Rav Kook, a completely modern movement. And so on and so forth. And he closes toward the very end, the last sentence before the closing of the brackets. He says that their attempt or their goal is l'sum b'har tzion pleita v'hatchalat smichat keren yeshua, the beginning of the sprouting of the horn of the redemption, v'hitno tzitzut ge'ula uftut, a flowering, a blossoming of redemption and salvation. So Rav Kook, A, writes beautifully. It's just gorgeous. It's if you can make it through the Hebrew and you're willing to put in the effort and the time and to really work it through, and then you understand each individual word, and then you sort of just go through the passage, it's so heartwarming. You feel like you're reading Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Those who are familiar with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's poems, there's one, the classic one in the keynote, the recited on Tisha B'Av, Tzion Halo Tishali. It's printed in Ashkenazic Sidurim, the 36th of the keynote. I know it's a while off, and certainly don't hope for the show. As always, are familiar with the tradition that they used to discard the keynote every year, but come Tisha B'Av this year, take a look at Kina 36. Take a look at Kina 36, Sion Halo Tishali, that of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. It's just a love poem. It's a love poem about the land of Israel. He wants to float over the land where the Avot walked. It's a beautiful, beautiful passage. And you read Rav Kook and his emotions, the wellsprings that you see coming through are just inspirational. But the content here, it's really an intellectual argument as well. It's a response to the claim that this is a new attempt, a new movement. It's actually part of that long-standing tradition. That's number one. And then Rav Kook adds something else as well. He says, hold on one second. The claim of the Satmar Rebbe is that this is a political, human-driven, essentially, movement. Right? This is an activist, a human initiative. Says Rav Kook, obviously that's true, and there's value to that, and there's no question. But if you read history, if you're just looking at the events that are taking place, and you're considering the notion of what's happened, the modern Zionist movement, beginning with the first Zionist Congress, 1897, looking at the events of World War I, the Balfour Declaration of 1917, the rebuilding of a land that had been desolate and had been abandoned or uninhabited by its people for some 2,000 years, and you think that this is just a human movement? This is unprecedented in history. This is clearly miraculous. There's no other plausible reading that anyone with a fair mind, with just a balance, just even a detached individual, with no bias, with no engagement on the issue whatsoever, would look at these historical events and recognize that they're unprecedented. You'll come to the conclusions of famous authors such as the Mark Twains of the world, who are not Jewish, and yet see the survival of the Jews, and then ultimately later thinkers who see the return of the Jews to be one of the modern, the miracles of modern times. There's no question about it. Says Rav Kook, this is not just a human movement. This is clearly divinely inspired. And of course, Rav Kook here is building upon his Kabbalistic and mystical perspective. If he's just a rationalist, maybe he can begin to ask the questions, but for him, it's just obvious. He's a monist. Everything ultimately comes from, as we said last week, a divine source, right? So it's all coming ultimately from God. So clearly, it's spiritual, it's religious in nature. So take a look, Rav Kook has a letter here, the next page. This is the one that, it's a letter entitled Tuf Tuf Ayin Aleph. So you'll take a look, it's toward the bottom. You see the right before the bracket, it says, Baruch Hashem, right, just to get the context, Yud Tet Shvat Tuf Resh Ayin Chet, where is he writing from? London. So those who were here last time, so you mentioned the biography of Rav Kook, 1914, he travels to an Agudath Israel convention to try to convince the anti-Zionists to get on the right side of the fence. He gets trapped in Western Europe for 5 years due to World War One. For a number of years of World War One, 1916 to 1919, he occupies the post as the spiritual leader of Machzike Hadas congregation in London. So, right, fits, okay, so it's confirmed, it all works out. This is written Tuf Resh Ayin Chet, writing from London, so it's 1918. So the rabbi and the community spends much of his energy and effort during these 5 years to encourage others to ultimately make Aliyah, to invest financially and otherwise in the nascent Zionist movement. So he writes a letter to Rabbi Dr. Moshe Zeidel, essentially in person's own right. In his own right, he writes as follows: Shalom Rav l'chol l'chol shalach l'chtachva. He says, your letter, beautiful letter, reached me. And then he says as follows in the next paragraph: Kinat chalta de geula vada. There's no question that the beginning of the redemption, we know this phrase, Rav Kook endorses this phraseology, certainly appears before us. Rav Kook, as an aside, believed that the events of World War I, followed by the issuing of the Balfour Declaration just 1 year earlier in 1917, were clearly a harbinger of the redemption. What many of us think about as the redemptive process, which is, or the 3 year, right, that 3 year period, when we think about 3 years apart, two critical events, what do we usually think of? Or having to do with potentially being the harbingers of the redemption, what do we think of? Of course, 1945 and 1948, because we think of World War II in retrospect, followed by the founding of the state. Rav Kook didn't have a founding of the state. He, living through World War I, it's very clear from his letters and from his diary entries that he believed that World War I was the traumatic episode, was Mochemes Gog u'Magog, as it well, was the great eschatological battle prior to the Messiah. And he believed that the Balfour Declaration 1917 confirmed that. And we're really moving toward the Messianic era. So he's writing in 1918, he's truly seeing Aschalta de Geula. And by the way, as an aside, his diaries have been published in the last 12 years. Some fascinating research, a book recently published, claiming that Rav Kook believed that he was, if not a potential messianic savior, I don't want to go there, but at minimum he and others of his generation were righteous, uniquely righteous individuals whose zechut and whose engagement with all Jews, not just with observant religious Jews, would ultimately help that, enable that process. Not just through their actual practical engagement, their political involvement, etc., but through their spiritual connectedness, bringing all Jews closer to the divine and therefore ultimately to the redemption. So the Rav Kook clearly sees himself playing an important role in this process, and others as well. It's a spiritual process, and 1918 is clearly a critical time in the thinking of Rav Kook. So now if you jump down to the last line, he says, he comes to our point, he says, you've misunderstood. He doesn't say Satmar Rebbe, you can't, but he says, you've completely missed the boat. He says, Lo al yidei maaseh adam v'tach pelotav. This process is clearly not man-made. This is not due to the actions of man and his machinations. Ki im al yidei mifleot tamim deim. Clearly, this is due to the wonders of the all-knowing, of the omniscient. You can turn to the next page. Turn the right way. That's what I did. Baal milchamotu matzmiach yeshuot. Clearly, these are the actions of the great warrior, of the one who blossoms salvation. And then he quotes a line that clearly he stole. Those are familiar from Rav Soloveitchik. There's no question about it. Vadai kol dodido feik. He says, "How can he do that to the Rav? It's terrible." Now, it may have been present in Shir HaShirim before that, he says that's like the joke that they say that in yeshiva, right, where they learn Gemara all day long, that Tanakh, that the Bible, is considered to be the chidushim, the novella of Kadosh Baruch Hu on Shas, right? God's commentary on the Gemara. So this is sort of the other way around. This is right right. We think we got right. Rav Soloveitchik came up with it, but actually, it may have come from the Bible. In any case, it's actually interesting to see that they both invoke this phraseology, kol dodido feik, and Rav Soloveitchik, particularly in reference to six events surrounding the modern return to Israel, which is very interesting. Did he? I mean, who knows? The Rav, pretty. I mean, he almost certainly read Rav Kook, that we know. I don't know, your guess is mine. Clearly, he took it in a little bit of a different direction, although it's a little bit, I mean, Kol Dodido Feik is interesting because on the one hand, he claims we can never understand the why, focus on the what, etc., but it's still a theological reading of history. And that's not so common for Rav Soloveitchik. So I think in elsewhere in his theology, he lived through these events. So I think it is interesting to see him adopting a more Rav Kook-esque kind of a theology of history, which is atypical for the Rav, but I think typical for Rav Kook. I don't know. I don't have any evidence, though. If anyone has anything, certainly let me know. In any case, he continues, and you see the basic thrust of the argument. In other words, Samar Rebbe's first and fundamental claim is that this is a human process, says Rav Kook. Come on. Clearly, this is an act, ultimately, of the divine. So to summarize, the Samar Rebbe claims this is this new movement, which is man-made. Rav Kook says this is a traditional movement. It's not a modern movement, number one. Number two, clearly, this is not just a human initiative, but clearly, this is with the sanction and with the urging of the divine, especially in 1918, after these, for Rav Kook, cataclysmic events of World War I. So that's the first and most fundamental point. And I'd like to spend just a little bit of time in closing, last few minutes that we have. Yes, please.
Could you explain what you just said, that Kol Dodido Feik is in line with Rav Kook's philosophy of living history, but not with the Rav's philosophy?
Well, I don't mean to say that it's counter to the Rav's philosophy, but I would say that it's extremely common. Rav Kook, the fourth class that we have will be Rav Kook on evolution. And Rav Kook on evolution is not just a question of fossils and dinosaurs, but it's sort of a question of how he looks at history in general and the process of history. Central to Rav Kook's philosophy is readings of history, is divine or theological readings of history. What is the significance of, for him, World War I? Well, that's Gogu Magog, that's a harbinger, that's the beginning of the Messianic era, and he does that throughout. He sees certain events in history, he reads them in a particular theological way. With Soloveitchik, I think the Rav much less than that. I don't think that that's nearly as central an aspect. The Rav focuses much more on human character, what we're meant to do, rather than what God does. Some have said the difference in Rav Kook is Rav Kook is theocentric, in terms of he focuses his energies discussing the divine, whereas the Rav focuses energies discussing man, different typologies of man, halakhic man, so on and so forth. So all I'm saying is that I don't think it's problematic, but I think it's a little bit atypical that the Rav spends so much energy in Kol Dodido Feik with a theological rendering of history. So I don't mean to say it's inconsistent or problematic for the Rav, I just mean it's somewhat atypical to spend so much energy on that topic, and I think in that sense it's reminiscent of Rav Kook. That's what I mean to say. Okay, yeah.
So if Rav Kook believed that this was a harbinger of the Messianic era,
yeah,
if he were alive today,
right? Careful, because two can play at that game. Right, that's always the problem, right? What would, you know, what
well,
would...
Well, I mean, Israel doesn't look messy, like it's the Messianic age.
This is one of the great challenges of contemporary Zionism. And we can laugh, but it's we can laugh, but we can cry as well, because the truth is that this is one of, there's a reason that, let's say, for example, already 10 years ago, Jewish Action, the Orthodox Union's magazine, ran a series of articles entitled, Is Religious Zionism in a State of Crisis? Okay, is religious Zionism in a state of crisis? Because what happens is, if you build your philosophy around the coming of the Messiah, and this is not the first time in history that we've learned this lesson, right? We've learned it right the hard way, whether it was Bar Kokhba, whether it was Shabtai Tzvi, Messianic anticipation, and then And then disappointment is really traumatic. It's traumatic for our people, for any people. So yes, there's a lot of struggle, right? When you make certain predictions also on the basis of history, when your rabbis say, on the basis of their reading of Rav Kook, that it's clear from Rav Kook that it's impossible for Hidnat Kut, for the disengagement, to actually become a reality. God would never allow that to take place because it would undermine our movement of Gishamunim, the settlement movement, toward the coming of the Messiah. And then, lo and behold, what happens? You tell that to all your children, to all of your youth, all of your adolescents have full faith that tomorrow will come and they will still be living in their homes. And then they're gone. You know, where does that leave a movement? So when you build a movement on history and a certain reading of history and then a certain predictive reading of history on that basis, it raises a lot of questions and creates a lot of crisis. So these are real challenges for the Lurja Zionist movement. And there's a great book, we got to move on, but I just mentioned this on the side, there's a great book about, I forget the title, something called, something like The Day After. I don't remember the exact title. And it's an individual who studied Lahavdil, I don't mean to compare fully, but a cult that believed that the end of days was coming a particular day. And the question is, what happens the next day when he didn't come? And in this case, it's not like these more frightening cases where people kill themselves or such things. So what he actually shows is, after having done studies of many cults, apparently, that believed that the end of the world was coming, and lo and behold, didn't happen, that the next day, their faith was strengthened overwhelmingly. Because what happened was, they found some reinterpretation. Oh, the reason that the world didn't end and the Messiah didn't come is because we weren't worthy. Mm-hmm. Right? So we've got to be even more worthy. So this is actually documented. We haven't seen that in religious Zionism. We'd have imagined that there being even deeper hasn't quite gone that way. I don't know. We never seem to fit the pattern of history. I don't know. It's interesting. But it is this question. How do you respond? Does it weaken your strength? Does it sort of ironically, counterintuitively strengthen your faith? But that's something we're struggling with mightily. And less Messianic Zionists are not struggling with nearly as mightily. And that's part of the trade-off. 100%. Okay. So just a few quick points. To close. So the Satmar Rebbe had mentioned the fundamental principle, right? Only divine, not human. I just want to quickly address the other assumptions. So tshuva precedes the political, tshuva must precede, right, the political redemption. That was the second assertion of the Satmar Rebbe. So you're Rav Kook. Those were here last time. Nearly two full classes on Rav Kook. Right? Nearly experts already. Right? Any thoughts? How would Rav Kook respond? Repentance must precede the Messianic era. What would you say? You're Rav Kook. Happy birthday. And you're Rav Kook's here. What would Rav Kook's new? What would he say?
Tshuva means coming back to Israel.
Okay. Good. Let's broaden that 100%. Right? Satmar Rebbe, your definition of tshuva is far too narrow. I think tshuva is about an individual who observes more commandments, who repents for sins and says, I'm going to recommit myself to not violate those sins anymore, to do more mitzvot. That's true. That certainly is tshuva. There's no question about that. But that's not all that tshuva is. Tshuva is much more profound. It's much broader. It casts a much wider net. Tshuva is actually about not just individuals, but about nations and about the entire universe. And it's not just about specific actions, but it's about the return. It's about a reunion with God. On the widest of levels. That's what tshuva truly is. The return to Zion is not a full-fledged tshuva. It's not the whole thing. It's not the full real McCoy, but it's meaningful. It's certainly, the return of the Jews to Israel is certainly part of the process of tshuva. Tshuva of our people, tshuva of our nation. Is it part of a return in terms of individual observance of the Torah? Clearly not. But ultimately it will be, says Rav Kook. It's part of the path to that ultimate repentance, that ultimate redemption. Clearly that's where we're going, but this is part of the tshuva process. So Satmar Rebbe, you're going to claim that tshuva must precede the redemption. I've got news for you. In part, it has. It has. That's how we define tshuva. And again, remember, Rav Kook, those over here, Rav Kook defines tshuva how? In relation to his essentially positive reading of the human character. Because ultimately humans, like all things, are rooted in the divine. There's that monism. Really, sin is just the rust that covers over our essentially good selves. So therefore, says Rav Kook, really we're essentially good people. The labor Zionists are, of course, according to Rav Kook, fundamentally wonderful people who are tapping into some profound sense of religiosity and spirituality that lies dormant deep within them. And they don't even realize it, but it's true, says Rav Kook. And therefore, certainly there's a meaningful act of a beginning of a return to the essential I, to that inner self. contrast this, I think, last time to the tshuva, the philosophy of Rav Soloveitchik. The Rav maintains that tshuva is a transformation into a different, a new personality. Cook says just the opposite. Tshuva is a return to the aboriginal self, to the true self. Just we get rid of all that junk that covers over our souls. So that's how Rav Kook says that, his response very beautifully. If you'd like to take a look, he says this on the next page. I'm not going to read it now. This is a passage taken from Orot HaTeshuvah, which essentially outlines this philosophy of tshuva. I'll just add as well that with regard to the other assertions of Sa'am Rebbe, and then I'll add one point to close. The third assumption we said is that the agents of redemption must be pious. Right, but clearly, what would he respond again? He would respond that they are pious, right? It's not just like this, it's about this. The labor Zionists are divinely inspired, not fully, it's not perfect. Cook is not a card-carrying secular Zionist. We're going to see in a moment, he's opposed to major aspects of secular Zionism, but he certainly believes that on some level they are pious. In terms of the fourth assumption, we'll leave that aside, the theocracy-democracy issue. Fascinating topic. What would be the ideal state of Rav Kook? He lives, of course, before. These questions are practical, so it's a little bit theoretical. There were democratic elections in these communities at that time, which Rav Kook discusses. In terms of his ideal reading of history, and Herzog and so on, that's a separate conversation, a fascinating one, but perhaps for another time. I just want to close by emphasizing that we shouldn't misunderstand Rav Kook. Was a proud supporter of and believed that there's tremendous religious and spiritual value, clearly, to the socialist labor Zionists, to the kibbutznikim, etc. At the same time, he believed that there's a balance. And he believed that they are critical to the process of redemption, but it's profoundly incomplete. That without a religious Zionism, there can be no full-fledged Zionism. In fact, he maintained that the Haredim, because for him, the anti-Zionists, who beat him up and verbally assaulted him and nearly verbally abused him left and right, they too bring something positive. He embraced them as well. What do they ensure? What do they accomplish? They keep us right on the straight and narrow. They keep us remembering that it's not just about the land, it's about what the land is supposed to mean, which is a reunion with God, which is religiosity, spirituality. And I just want to close. I know I'm a little bit over time, but I think it's worthwhile to mention two points in closing. The first is as follows, that Rav Kook, I think, is a beautiful metaphor. Take a look at this last copied page. Ma'amere ha-ra'aya ha-mispeid b'Yerushalayim. The eulogy in Jerusalem. This is Rav Kook's eulogy for none other than Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl. You have it. Part of it here is from a Viki text, which you might be familiar with, which is an ancient discovered manuscript from the Cairo Geniza, of course, also known as Wikitext. It's better than finding it on WikiLeaks. It could have been worse. So anyhow, essentially, I'll give you, you can read it for yourself here or online. I don't know if it's been translated, though, so I'll give you the quick summary. Basically, he says as follows. He says, we know that in Jewish tradition there are not one, but there are two messianic personalities. Who are they? Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. Right? These are Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. So he says, essentially, what's the difference between Yosef and David? Yosef is the physical, is the material Messiah, and David is the spiritual Messiah. That's his claim. We know, according to the accounting, that Mashiach ben Yosef will die, according to the traditional narrative. He dies, and then who revives him at the end of days? Mashiach ben David. So that's what we know. So that's Rav Kook. God couldn't do all of this with one Messiah alone. Especially the first one's going to die, for God's sake. Like, well, what's he doing there? What's his role? Why do we need a Mashiach ben Yosef? So says Rav Kook, this is exactly a metaphor for Herzl as an individual, but really it's almost as if he's saying Herzl is Mashiach ben Yosef, which is a remarkable kind of thing. But basically he says the secular Zionists are the Mashiach ben Yosef. They're bringing about the material identity with the land, the return to the land. They're critical to the process of exile, but they can't get us there all the way. Without Mashiach ben David, ultimately it will die, and it will never be resuscitated. We need the religious Zionists, we need the observance of mitzvot, and so on and so forth, to enhance, to build upon the achievements of Herzl, of the Mashiach ben Yosef, and all of those with him, to then take us to that next level. So I think Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David, becomes a very fitting paradigm for this sort of dichotomy. It's for on one hand it's imperfect, on the other hand it is Mashiach ben Yosef. He did basically call Herzl, without saying so explicitly, Mashiach Ben Yosef, that's not too bad. So it's a little better than the Satmar Rebbe would have given him, I'd imagine. So you get the idea. So that sort of, I think, is metaphorical. He speaks his approach. And then finally, I just wanted to point your attention to the other handouts. To get there before it's too late, this is also a metaphor for Rav Kook's discomfiture with secular Zionism. Rav Kook read HaTikva and thought that there were many positive aspects to Naftali Hertz Imber's classic song, but Rav Kook disagreed. He did not love HaTikva. He found it to be weak. He was profoundly had tremendous allegiance. He didn't tell people not to ever sing it or anything like that, but he did have certain concerns with that, and he actually wrote a counter suggestion. He wrote his own proposed national anthem. We're not going to read it inside, but if you take a look, instead of more secular terms, he talks about La'ad Chayav Bilvavinu, it's forever. It's not just 2,000 years, but it's forever in the Jewish heart. He speaks about Ha'emunah, which is a more religious has more religious connotation. Shamina Avod Elokeinu, we're going to serve God. So again, he had tremendous respect for, reverence for. He didn't say we shouldn't sing HaTikva, but he did have certain discomfiture with it because he felt that it reflected a secular Zionist vision, which was extremely valuable, which is Mashiach ben Yosef, but ultimately could not get us there all the way. So hopefully this is a well-rounded portrait. I want to thank you for your time. Again, hopefully this gives us a well-rounded sense of Rav Kook's philosophy. And certainly we hope that Mashiach ben Yosef has come. Certainly we hope that Mashiach ben David will come as well. But certainly we hope that we don't get traumatized along the way due to our over-reading of history. So hopefully we'll get that balance right. Next week we will pick it up. You can join again Wednesday evening or Tuesday morning here at 9:30 upstairs in the library. We're going to be discussing Rav Kook on art, which is not one of the major themes in Rav Kook's life. It's actually very intriguing. It's very thought-provoking. In particular, we have some an article found dug up. You can either dig it up with me or you can Google it. But either way, it's an article from a British newspaper, Rav Kook on Rembrandt. So you had some very interesting comments there. But in more generally, the creative process, the room for the creative process, individual, talking about nationalism here. What about the creative capacities of the individual? And they're going to use art as a prism into that theme of Cook's thought. Thank all for joining. Have a good evening.
Thank you.